A fire still rages in the Amazon rainforest, and some consumers of American news have been critical of the fact that this seeming environmental disaster hasn't been getting more of our attention. On social media, comparisons to the media response to Notre Dame burning in Paris and the Amazon burning in Brazil went viral. Even those have quieted down, though the fire has not. Meanwhile, few of us have the cultural context to understand what exactly has been going on there. Is the fire totally out of the ordinary? Does this just happen? What are the politics around the South American response? Well, expertise might be easier to find than you'd think. One KU researcher has conducted a satellite study to get a better understanding of how the fire is changing the environment. Gabriel de Oliveira, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Linda. Good morning, everyone. I'm very happy to be here talking about the Amazon in such an important week.
So, first of all, how did you, a postdoctoral researcher at KU's Department of Geography and Atmospheric Science, come to be conducting satellite studies of the Amazon rainforest? What's your personal relationship to this work?
So, yes, I was born in South Brazil, so I finished my undergrad there, and then I moved to the Brazilian Space Agency, which is in Sao Paulo State, and then I got there, you know, I'm from South Brazil, I had no idea how the Amazon looked like or anything, but my advisor told me, Gabriel, you're going to work in the Amazon rainforest, and that's going to be your research, and I said, okay. So, and then she sent me to the Amazon for like 2 or 3 months, and then went back to the space agency and I started doing my studies. So that was back in 2010. So I finished my master's in remote sensing, which is the science that studies the satellite images and satellite data collection. Finished my master's and then I did my PhD at the Brazilian Space Agency, which is called INPE. So it was that's why I started doing the research in the Amazon. So that's been like 9 years for now. And then when I finished my PhD there, I got the opportunity to come here to KU to work, and it's been very interesting. So that's my story.
When you say that this is such an important week, what do you mean by that?
Just all about the discussions at United Nations. We're going to have leaders from all over the world talking about climate change. The president of Brazil actually will be giving the first speech. I think it's tomorrow morning. So everybody's kind of waiting for that and what he's going to say and what the other leaders will say about what we're experiencing in the Amazon and in this year. So I think it's very important.
What exactly is it that you have been trying to understand about the impact of this fire?
Yes. So my research focus on the... So when we have the primary forest or the old growth forest, I mean like trees with 40, 50 meters tall. So when we have the conversion of this ecosystem to, for example, agriculture or pasture for cattle, so we have a change in this environment, right? So my research focuses exactly on that. What is the impact when we convert this beautiful, tall forest to this type of ecosystem, such as I said, agriculture or pasture? What is the impact mostly in the soil temperature, surface and air temperature, and also in the evaporation? And the evaporation, I mean all the water that is released from these ecosystems to the atmosphere. So that's been my research, and the fire has a very important role, and that's something that I wanted to highlight. So deforestation has three stages in general. The first stage is when you cut the most valuable species, right? Tree species. So you cut the most valuable species, and the next step is the fire to clean the land. And then after cleaning the land, you either start agriculture or pasture. So my research focuses on trying to understand exactly that. When we have this conversion, right, they cut the most valuable species, they set fire, and then they have the conversion, what is the impact in the environment? That's my research. That's what my research is about.
What have you learned so far?
So we just published a very important article a month ago trying to show using NASA satellite with a very high spatial resolution, like 15 meters, which is the highest we can get to do this type of study in the Amazon. And we were able to find that when you convert this primary forest to pasture or soybean, we have an increase in the soil and the air temperature 2 to 4 times, like we have a temperature 2 to 4 times higher over pasture or soy than in the forest.
And that's, and also, that's long term. That's not just like when there was just a fire.
Yeah, no, that's a long term. That's what you're going to expect when you convert this environment to pasture or soy. We have an increase in air temperature and soil temperature or surface temperature 2 to 4 times. So those are the main impacts that we have found in this paper just published. And the other big impact...
So you're not saying 2 to 4 degrees. You're saying 2 to 4 times.
2 to 4 times.
As hot?
Yeah, 2 to 4. As hot, exactly.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. So yes. So that's why this paper is being, like, you know, it's being also in the media. People have been talking about, because this is a long term study. We use this such a high, as I said, a satellite, high resolution spatial resolution satellite images. So we were able to find that. So we have this increase in temperature, and we also have this huge decrease in evaporation. So we have. So the evaporation tends to decrease 2 times when you convert the primary forest to soybean or agriculture. I mean soybean. So we have also this decrease in evaporation. We have an increase in soil and air temperature and decrease in evaporation. And evaporation in the tropics or in the Amazon has such an important role, because all the water that's pumped back to the atmosphere goes to the tropics, and then this water goes to the other tropics and the polar regions. So that's very important. So those are the main findings in this study.
You want this work to be used in policymaking, right?
Yes, I think so. This work was conducted in the southwestern part of the Brazilian Amazon. So this part started to be deforested in the 70s because of some politics at that time. So this area is being very degraded. It's actually very sad. I've been there several times, and I feel like when we decided to conduct this study in that area, we was trying to show to, you know, the politics and policymakers that it's more than time than to do something, you know, because we've been seeing this for, you know, as I said, for the past 40 years, you know, but it's been increasing a lot. So another thing that I wanted to highlight real fast is that we had a decrease in deforestation in the Amazon from 2004 to 2016, I would say. And then after 2016, because a lot of, you know, political crisis in Brazil, we started seeing again this increase in deforestation. And the deforestation this year has reached its peak in the history. So they started to do mapping of the deforestation in the Amazon in the 80s. So this has been the peak. We never seen anything similar to that. So that's why we are very concerned about. And I feel like this study came out in a good time to show that to the policymakers.
And that is something that I want to understand a little bit better while we have you. What do you think that the typical, you know, person in Kansas or Missouri may not fully understand about the policy response or lack thereof and where it comes from?
Right. So I feel like since this new term of the new president of Brazil, we've been seeing So how can I put this? It's been very complicated for scientists and researchers in Brazil to conduct research in terms of environment, and especially to the Amazon. And that's a short story. Remember I said I did my master's and PhD at the Brazilian Space Agency. So the Brazilian Space Agency is the government agency responsible to do the monitoring of deforestation, right? So all the news you read about deforestation in the Amazon, it's the Brazilian Space Agency that conducts this mapping. And this mapping is validated all over the world. Scientists all over the world recognize INPE as, you know, a solid and great institution working with the deforestation. But since the new president started, he started saying things that he didn't trust in the mapping, that the mapping was wrong. And he ended up firing the director at the Brazilian Space Agency, I think it was beginning of May, because he said that deforestation was wrong. And the director at INPE said, well, this mapping is being done since 1980s, is being validated researchers all over the world can access. It's free. It's on internet. You can access the data, and the president still didn't believe that, so he fired the director of INPE. And so at that time, the deforestation was, you know, is really, really high. So INPE was already sending alerts to the federal government saying, like, look, do something, send the federal police or something, because they are deforestating these areas. And the government didn't do anything about. And so remember in the beginning I said, so the first stage of deforestation is when you cut the most valuable species. So you see in the satellite images, you know, that pattern of the deforestation is starting. And the next step after that, as you remember, is the fire. So, and the fire starts during the dry season, and the dry season is right now. So that's why we've been seeing like this huge increase also in fires in the Amazon, because we showed there in the beginning of the year that deforestation was occurring, and the second stage is the fire. So now we're seeing the fire, which actually validates the data from the Brazilian Space Agency that the president didn't believe.
You know, when you describe the political context, it seems like that would make the kind of work you are doing from here as someone not operating out of Brazil really important.
Exactly. So it's really important because, I mean, in our group, so the leader of our group is Dr. Nate Brunzel here. He's the chair of the Department of Geography and Atmospheric Science. So we both are leading these studies here from KU, but we have collaborators from University of Michigan. We have collaborators from the University of Arizona. We have collaborators from the Brazilian Space Agency. We have like 3 or 4 researchers there working pretty close to us. We have researchers in the Amazon rainforest doing work, doing field work, and sending us data. So we have this group, and I feel like, yes, it's very important to have this opportunity to be working from here, but at the same time connecting these two environments, you know, Brazil and the U.S., you know, doing research together for a main common for, you know, to have like just good results about and try to understand what's going on.
As someone who lives in Kansas but has expertise in the Amazon, are there things that people here you think may not really understand in trying to interpret the news about the fire itself?
Yes. One thing that I wanted actually to highlight is that fires in the Amazon, they happen every year. Okay, that's a pretty straightforward thing. So fires in the Amazon happens every year because the areas that have been already deforested, the farmers, they set fire to clean, you know, the pasture mostly the pasture to be able to put the cattle again next year, because the soil in the Amazon is very, very bad for agriculture. So they set fire so they can have a better soil for the next year. So fires happen, right? And also there are no natural fires in the Amazon. All fires in the Amazon are human induced. So those are 2 things. Fires happen every year, and there are no natural fires in the Amazon. So
that means that the fires have been happening every year, but they're happening every year for man-made reasons.
Exactly. So fires happen every year, right? And but this year, we haven't seen anything similar to this. And what's going on this year is like we've been seeing fires over forest. We usually see fires, you know, over already deforested areas from the past. So it's just like in the pasture areas or agricultural areas, we've been seeing fires. But currently, we've been seeing a lot of fires happening in the forest. So it's a pretty clear pattern that deforestation occurring this year, as I said. In February, March this year, with the satellite, we could see that these areas were starting to be deforested and the clear cut was occurring. And the next stage is the fire, just to clean that area. And probably by December, October, if we look these areas again in the satellite images, we're going to see either pasture or agriculture. So this year, it's being a very bad year. And also, another thing that it's very important for people from Kansas and Missouri to know is that drought years, they happen in the Amazon. And during drought years, we can have like an increase in fires, because sometimes the farmers, they put fire in their land and the fire gets out of control and reach the forest. So that also happens. But this year is not a drought year in the Amazon. It's a pretty wet year in the Amazon. So that's not an excuse that also some of the policymakers down there in Brazil, they were saying it's a drought year. But no, our measurements, they've shown that it's not a drought year. And so we have these three things working together. It's not a drought year, and we've been seeing forests fires in the forest, not only on farmlands.
What will you be wondering and hoping to find out as you continue to follow this news story about this fire in the Amazon?
I feel like doing research and trying to understand these impacts and trying to show to a broader public what's going on, I think maybe we'll make the policymakers on people to understand more what's going on, and then take some actions to reduce this. I feel like we've seen people saying that the Amazon it belongs to Brazil and blah blah blah. I mean, yes, the Amazon, it's within Brazil limits and Brazil borders, but I do believe that the Amazon, it belongs to the world, you know, and I think it's our role to care about and do things about it. And so I feel like that's the main thing that I wanted to see in the media in the next months or the next years, that the deforestation has been reducing and we can preserve this amazing and beautiful ecosystem.
Gabriel de Oliveira, postdoctoral researcher at KU, thank you so much for talking to us about your research on satellite imagery and data gathering from the Amazon.
Thank you so much for the opportunity again, and I'm always happy and able to talk about. Thank you so much.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Up next, is Kansas City a good place to get started as an artist? Join that discussion next. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now let's begin a conversation I'm casually titling Portrait of the Artist as a Young Kansas Cityan. Brandon Frederick runs an artist collective here in town called Open House. He has a little news to share, so I'll let him start us off by sharing that news now. Brandon, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So your news is?
Our news is that this next exhibition will be our last.
The next exhibition at Open House.
Yes. Yeah. The first Saturday of October.
What is Open House? Why does it exist? Who does it exist for? Can you give some of that backstory?
Sure. So it exists kind of as a, started as a dream. I lived next to that house for 6 years.
And this is where?
In the West Plaza neighborhood on State Line Road. And it just kind of was like a place that somebody came and mowed the lawn every month. And I'm fascinated by alternative venues for art, and eventually got access to the space and kind of used it as a platform for artists to collaborate with the space and also think about ways to connect with the neighborhood and like provide an avenue for people to connect to art in a way that they might not be able to access otherwise.
So can you give an example of the way people, first of all, collaborated with the space itself?
Well, you kind of have to. It's basically like studs. So like it's mid renovation. So all the lath and plaster had been removed. So you can't just kind of access it like you would a gallery space. You kind of have to think about how to use it. You can see through one wall to another part of the space. So there's like an access where like whatever you're doing inside that space is going to be visible, unless you kind of modify as you're going along.
So then what about the way that people are, you feel, interacting with the neighborhood and then vice versa, like the neighborhood and the public interacting with the space in a way that isn't typical for the artist, non-artist interaction?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a busy street, so people drive by, walk by a lot. One of our programs, Garage School, was really directed towards bringing people from the neighborhood in by providing free educational workshops that were led by artists. But then, you know, also things like our neighbors who are across the street and they look through the window like at our last show, First Date, and they're like, I see this really cool quilted piece through the window, and I just had to come over and look at it and talk to the artist. And so just those kinds of like interactions.
There's that visual stimulation where they already are in their lives.
Right. And it's kind of an unexpected thing. And you're like walking past a house and you look in the window and you see something happening that is not what you would expect to be seeing.
So why won't you be continuing to do this?
Well, it's like a lot of those projects for artists, right? It's a volunteer run, and there's fundraising involved to make it work. And I've kind of gotten to the point where I've been doing projects like this for like almost 10 years. And I would like a little bit of a break and kind of focus on my own studio practice. And I just, the prospect of doing more fundraising right now was not really super appealing.
Okay, so this brings me to the larger conversation I'm kind of hoping to have today. I have been around long enough to see places like this come and go, to see different artist collectives spring up out of nowhere and then kind of go by the wayside. They don't tend to last all that long, but they do mean a lot to the people involved. From both a career standpoint and a social perspective, they make Kansas City, I would say, for a group of people, an exciting place to make art, to see art, when you're not operating at that museum or like gallery solo show kind of level. And let's face it, not many people are. Certainly very few, if any, start that way. So what would you say is the role of the artist collective in a young artist's career?
Yeah, it gives people a community to connect with. It gives them kind of like a foundation of other artists to see what they're doing and what their practice is like and kind of reflect on what they do as an artist. But also it's an opportunity for those artists to experiment, to try new things in new ways, and to really explore ideas in a way that they wouldn't have access to in a commercial space, in a gallery, or like in an institution, like you're saying, they're not going to have that opportunity right away.
If ever.
Right, if ever. Yeah, exactly.
So on its own, the closure of one collective would not catch my attention, but it does seem that there's kind of a wave of non-commercial collectives and exhibition spaces calling it quits right now. Do you think that there is a bigger story in that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like you're saying, it is cyclical. Like these things kind of go in waves. But also at the same time, Kansas City is experiencing, you know, its own sort of wave of gentrification that's happening. And even if the space itself wasn't directly affected in terms of its cost of operation, you're also thinking about rental costs for those artists that are living in the city increasing or being displaced and having to move to other areas. And this is not just affecting artists, obviously. This is everyone in the city. It's significantly more expensive to live here than I went to school here.
The larger real estate story is right. Having an effect on the arts, you feel.
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's hear from someone else who's part of this story. She ran Front Space in what used to be the drugstore. Both Front Space and the drugstore have been artists' collectives operating out of that old Osco drug building with the really cool orange clock tower in Westport. Patricia Bordayo de Bieldox, hello.
Hi.
Can you tell the story of the drugstore and Front Space?
Sure. I do want to clarify, I didn't run the drugstore. I was a resident there, and I came into it, I think, in its fourth out of 7 years. Was it 7 years, Brandon? Brandon was also a resident.
Okay. Yeah, it was 7 years.
And what was really cool about it is that it provided kind of like unbelievably cheap studio spaces for artists, aside from the Charlotte Street Foundation that provides free studio spaces for artists in the city. The drugstore definitely was kind of like the runner-up. And
so what is the significance of inexpensive studio space to a young artist getting their start? For people who just aren't part of that world, don't overlap with it?
Sure. I think one of the things that people don't realize about artists is that our practices, well, maybe people do, that's kind of presumptuous for me to say, but our practices don't align in many ways, whereas like Brandon literally has a wood shop in his studio at the drugstore. He had like, you know, saws and all the stuff that comes with building frames and walls, whereas my studio is like fiber-based and photography-based. So
fiber-based meaning fabric.
Yes. Yeah, I did some quilting, some soft sculpture, kind of all over the place. So that being said, to say that we can't operate out of like our living rooms a lot of times. Like for Brandon, you can't have no ventilation, and like people working with like oil paints, you need like an adequate space, a big space to make a lot of projects happen. And having the drugstore for that many years was a really huge gift, because it allowed a lot of us to expand our practices in ways that a small, expensive space wouldn't have allowed us to.
How does your personal story as an artist fit into the story of these two artist collectives?
Sure. And I didn't talk about Front Space very much, but I started running that about a year and a half ago after Madeline Gallucci and Kendall Harbin kind of like passed the torch along to us. That space started in 2009, so it was there for it started in 2010, so almost 10 years we were in the crossroads. And after I graduated from school, I did a lot of internships in museums and galleries. I went even like to Europe to do an internship because I was really set on doing work in institutions, such as the like bigger museums. And after I came back, I felt pretty disconnected from the kind of work that happens in bigger institutions. Not that I don't respect it and appreciate it, because I love the work that institutions like the Nelson do here and provide it for free to the public. So I think that's really valuable. But I came back and really felt the want and the need to strengthen the kind of like the DIY arts community here. So
can I jump in and say that's sure. Something that I think is super interesting is that I have had a lot of friendships and working relationships with a lot of working artists in Kansas City. I have also worked at arts institutions. And the disconnect between when people in Kansas City talk about Kansas City being an art city, sometimes they're talking about the institutions and whether they're thriving. And sometimes they're talking about those communities of artists and whether they're thriving. And those are very different questions. And there's actually like very little overlap in the communities around mm-hmm. those two things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great point. Whenever we're having these conversations, I think a lot of people who are not knowledgeable about the work that goes on in kind of like the more DIY and alternative spaces throughout the city is that people in their minds, and rightfully so, they're like, well, the Kemper is fine, the Nelson is fine, the Nerman is fine. And that's because huge money is going to those institutions with a lot of work. Obviously, all of those places have grant writers and board of trustees and like people working to get that money. But when you talk about volunteer run spaces, such as the ones we all have been parts of, we're doing that work full time, like on top of full time jobs. We have a full time job to run the space and keep it funded. So I feel like a huge disconnect for people who don't understand the work that we're doing is that we're essentially taking on what could be three different jobs at a bigger institution.
So tell me about the art you make and how old you are and where you feel you are in that process and what spaces like the ones that are, as you say, DIY, run by you and people like you, what the importance of those has been.
Yeah, I have to think about 26 years old. I just turned 26.
That's a little young to start forgetting how old you are.
Yeah. it was just my birthday. I'm bad at numbers. I am 26, and I moved to Kansas City when I was 8. So I've been here for 17 years, 16 years almost. One of
something
those numbers.
Like that.
Yeah, something like that. And throughout that whole time, I've made work. I've been very photography leaning throughout that whole time. And when I left school, I started doing a lot of fiber-based work because of, again, like the drugstore shifted my practice really radically because I was able to set up a sewing studio and do crazy like indigo dyeing. I didn't care. I had to like
access to the tools and the kind of space you needed to try something that ended up really speaking to you.
Yeah, definitely. And I think now, and I credit a lot of my conversations with Melanie Mitchell, who ran like two other alternative spaces here in the city, about the way that we're approaching our art practices now as kind of like not saving, I don't want to sound like a savior type person, but essentially focusing our practices in helping this transition happen. So my work right now, my actual creative work is on hold / has transitioned to this conversation. So I'm not making work until I can figure out what's next.
What's next for, like, what's the next collective? What's the next space? What's the next?
I don't know if necessarily like what specific collective is popping up, but I think whenever I talk to Melanie a lot about this is that I feel like as an artist who has been lucky enough to hold such a accessible, like big studio space for a long time, is that I kind of owe it to the younger artists in the city, either coming into the city or getting ready to graduate, wherever they are in their practice. Like, I feel like having had the opportunity to make work in such a like incredible space with such an incredible community, because the drugstore, I mean, it really is some of the best people I've ever worked alongside. I think we owe it to a younger generation of makers to have these conversations. And for me personally, and for Melanie as well, it's been kind of like putting our practice to the side and making this kind of like creative focus in terms of what is next, big picture.
Well, so how do you see that picture looking right now? I mean, what would you say is, if you're just taking a snapshot of right now, 2019, mm-hmm. young artists between 20 and 25 years old, trying to get their start here in town right now, where are the opportunities? What are the challenges? What do you see changing?
Like Brandon mentioned, I think a huge problem is housing, and the cost of renting anything in the city now is drastically different than it has been since even I started school. And I haven't been out of school for that long, but I think the bigger question beyond the arts community is the just like what affordable housing looks here. It's like a moral issue rather than just like, can we make work or not? It's like what other people are barely getting through in the city. I work a full-time job and still struggle to like rent an apartment that is adequate. So I think the best, to me, in my eyes, the best first step is kind of figuring out like what it looks like for everybody in the city before we start moving into like, well, I want to open up like this studio space, because I think that solves one issue until you get kicked out of that one because it gets flipped. So yeah.
Brandon, jump back in here.
Sorry. in terms of like artists and
yeah,
like
where
artists,
we are right
we
now
are
in
right
Kansas
now.
City.
Sorry, I was just really wrapped up in what Patricia was saying. I think that there's this question of, you know, where do you make work after you graduate from one of these institutions, or like what is the space that's available to you? What are the opportunities that are available to you? And there are some, but there definitely needs to be more. And it is part of this larger conversation also of like, how do we see the vision and future of Kansas City? And
why do you think it's part of that?
Because, I mean, we're all sharing this space together. So, you know, we have to be in tune with all of, like, everyone in this space and what our collective needs are. Because we don't necessarily, I don't know, I don't want to, you know, become another place where everyone's fleeing and having to, you know, there's tent cities popping up. I was in the Bay Area last summer, and whole parks in Oakland are taken up with tents. Because it's so expensive to live there. Like, you could work a full-time job, and if you make under $100,000 there, you're poor, basically.
I know that this seems like maybe not the highest priority question in the context of what you just said, but since we are having a conversation about the arts, how do you see that affecting the arts in those cities and the work being created by artists in those cities?
I mean, I can say just through running Open House, I've met many artists who have moved here from those places because they know that they can't afford to live there anymore. They know that they can actually still like potentially buy a house in this area. But yeah, I mean, there's no access to space to make things. So the amount of kind of like DIY artist run projects are shrinking in those spaces. And then there's things like,
and that's where usually like a next generation of art comes from.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something I have wondered is whether we have stepping stones in place in Kansas City, because I have seen a lot of what you're talking about, but you also see new institutions that didn't exist 30 years ago, like Charlotte Street, like Artists Inc. Has that provided some of those stepping stones, or in the absence of like revered MFA programs, residencies, things like that, is there a lack?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, Charlotte Street is amazing, and I feel like they are in tune with the needs of artists because it's run by an artist, and they are trying to fill all the gaps. And really, we need, you know, like a couple more Charlotte Streets to, you know, and an MFA program would definitely be a part of that conversation as well.
Patricia?
I think going back to like the question of what are we providing artists, or like how does the transition happen and people keep on making work or not, I feel like something that is a huge part of this conversation too is that if we're not providing affordable spaces, both housing and studio spaces, opportunities for, because I agree, Charlotte Street is incredible. There are other institutions that are doing a lot of work in the city, but they, according, like compared to the percentage of artists that there are in the city, they can only cover so much of those needs. So I've seen a lot of uptick in people leaving, you know,
like I've started seeing that.
Absolutely. And it's people who, I mean, it's almost like painful to see them go because they've contributed so much, and it's happening quickly.
You can join this conversation at 816-235-2888. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll get some recent history on all of that. Was it really so much different 20 years ago? Before the arts here, you could say they boomed. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us and tell your story. 816-235-2888. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking now about a wave we're currently seeing of artists' collectives in town shutting down. It's inspired us to ask what it's like for young artists trying to get their start in Kansas City today. Now that art is on most of the city's radar, is forging a career in the arts any easier, or have the challenges just shifted and changed? 816-235-2888 is the number to call with your story, your perspective. We want to hear from artists, and quickly, no matter what vintage, but especially the young ones. 816-235-2888. I'm joined now by an artist of my vintage, Davin Watney, who was doing scrappy young artist things here in the West Bottoms in the late 90s and early 2000s. He now curates shows at a gallery at UMKC, so he's still in touch with the youth. Hi,
Davin.
That's
right. Hi.
What are you hearing? Has this conversation made you think about things any differently, or is it part of the conversation you're always having?
A little bit of both, you know. It's definitely a conversation that's always happened, you know. I think I have the lifespan to have a little bit more of a perspective on this. I've seen these kind of waves come and go. But being in the position I am now, where I am a property owner, I do have a full-time job, I also have a family and things like that, so my roots are a little more settled here, as I can start to see kind of like the grander picture. And I just think like we're at a moment where things are shifting. And a lot of it is because we're experiencing such a huge boom in development. And I sometimes wonder if we're in a bubble as far as that goes.
If we are, what do you think that means for artists with your long view that you now have?
Well, what I think is like artists are, this analogy has been made before, but they're the worms that till up the rich soil. And I think Kansas City has been a fertile soil for these kind of DIY kind of creative moments because it does have relatively inexpensive property. You can raise a family here.
I mean, this is all so relative.
Yes, it is.
Depending on who you are and what resources you have.
That's true. That's true. And I do see those things are changing, totally. But from in the 90s, when I was graduating from the Art Institute, same place Brandon and Patricia graduated from, there was really nothing going on. But there was an abundance of cheap property. I think now where the property is, you know, where the inexpensive property is going, it's a little farther out from the city. At first, it was the city because the city was just a vacuum. There was nothing going on. But now all those resources have been put back into the center core. Now I think the artists are going to be pushed out.
We were talking earlier, I mean, maybe it was just last week on this show, about opportunities in abandoned or just changing shopping malls. Thinking about sort of like the suburban shopping mall as the, like, you know, in the 90s, it was the old warehouses.
Right.
And they had that gritty charm, and there was an aesthetic that you associated with that. And now to think of that, maybe the next wave of that is an old shopping mall, or maybe like an old office park or something.
Totally. Well, it's like I drive by on Merriam, there's like a huge old, I think Habitat Restore was there for a little while. There's an old Sears Kmart out on, Johnson Drive, I think. Yeah, and I think, but you know, it's like artists, they like community. They like being close to where they work and where they live. And there's something about urbanity.
To live the life.
Yeah. So I think malls, because of their kind of more proximity to suburbia, big highways, it's not such an aesthetic that is attractive. But it might be where we have to go. I don't know.
So we're going to bring in some of our listeners on this, but they're going to be speaking with our other guests too, Brandon Frederick and Patricia DeBildox. And we're going to go now to Pamela in Midtown. Hi, Pamela.
Hello. I have some observations and questions. The first one is, you know, if it really weren't for the artists with the First Fridays, that really, you know, years ago brought in so much tourism and people coming in to the city, wouldn't the city, you know, have some kind of a tourism fund that would help these artists, because it is part of, you know, the growing tourism here in Kansas City to promote the artists and to make sure that they have affordable housing and so forth.
Well, Pamela, that's an interesting idea. I'm going to go ahead and let the artists in the room speak to this. Patricia, what do you think of what Pamela is suggesting, that since tourism since artists contribute to tourism and the appeal of tourism, that maybe a tourism fund could support artists?
I feel like this kind of ties into what just happened with open spaces and the fact that the city, I think, is really keen on supporting arts and culture, but it's usually top-down rather than bottom-up situations where the people receiving the funding are institutions that have really solid backbones here in the city, which I don't think that's universal. I feel like there are some incentives to, like, make work happen, but very rarely in my time working, and I'd be interested to hear what Davin has to hear since he's got more of a history, like, I just don't feel like I've ever had much support that I've seen with those incentives.
Yeah, I have a thought on that. I think, you know, some type, nobody likes tax policy and tax initiatives. That's always tough to get through legislatively. I would think, I'm not a politician, but I would think the best way with regard to the blossoming of development and the attraction of the crossroads is a lot of that stuff, art seems to be the subject, but it's not where people filter. They go to the restaurants. That's not where people spend their money. The best way to support artists is to go to Front Space or to go to Open House and to buy something. You're putting money directly in the pockets of people, and there's no need for tax. There's just a need for to, like, I guess, patronage, you know, is really, and to kind of, if you think of it this way, the money you'd spend for drinks and a dinner at any one of the number of restaurants, great restaurants, this is not picking on anybody, in the Crossroads, if that were to be funneled towards a piece by an emerging artist, they would be pretty comparable, I would think, and would go pretty far. So I just think, like, the real patronage could be shifted towards, you know, a mindset of collecting work.
How do you think that patronage, and especially as it applies to young emerging artists, compares in Kansas City to other markets?
Well, I don't know. I think, I can tell you from my experience, this is a long time ago, you know, one of the things we did at the Dirt Gallery, which is a gallery I ran from 96 to about 2003, is we did do some art fairs. And there are art fairs that were, again, centered on more DIY spaces. There was one in Miami that was part of Miami Basel, and then there was a part, and then there was one in New York. And what I saw was the New York market was way more willing to experiment, to take a chance, and buy art from emerging artists in Kansas City that people wouldn't even touch in Kansas City. So I see, you know, guys from Wall Street waltzing in, you know, like, I like this, I'm going to buy it, throw them down money. And that was in the 90s. So I thought, wow, what is missing in Kansas City? And I think there's been a big push, and there's a lot of people to thank for that. I think Charlotte, going back to Charlotte Street, people like David Hughes and Kate Hackman and some of those folks that kind of really, Bruce Hartman, people that start to see like, okay, we have a collector base here in Kansas City. How can we kind of, you know, guide these collectors to more towards these emerging artists that are really talented, and once you get a little money in their pocket, they're more likely to stick around in Kansas City and spread those opportunities along. So, you know, like Brandon and Patricia are pretty successful graduates. They're able to then kind of you know, pass along their success to other artists or give a platform to other artists. So it does filter down, and a lot of that comes from patronage.
Brandon, what do you think about all of this?
I think about this a lot because, you know, you see some wall art from IKEA in somebody's house and you're like, you think about that and like, I could show you 100 artists or you could buy something at a similar price point and you'd have an original piece of art in your house. And so like, there's structures that we could even think about making with the right support to make those kinds of things happen. I think a lot about this website in Minnesota. It's called mnartists.org, and it's an awesome resource. It has a directory of artists in Minnesota, has artist opportunities.
So that if a person who is like, I need something for my house, I don't have time to do anything but go to IKEA,
right,
they could instead go to that website and find out what's there that isn't IKEA.
Yeah, which of course this takes resources to make happen, but there are like, I think there's ways to kind of like build that patronage from the ground up.
Let's talk to Kathy. Kathy's calling from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. My question is, you know, what is affordable for an artist? I'm interested in developing some property in the east side of Kansas City. I'm actually doing it now, and I really would like to have artists moving into that area. Things are very affordable, but what is affordable? And second question is, would they come?
Okay, let's. I want to direct this to Patricia because I know that the complications around the questions Kathy is asking are of particular interest to you as well.
Mm-hmm. I think something that we've been thinking a lot about with, because I've had conversations with like city people, other artists, all sorts of organizers when moving out of the drugstore in Front Space, about everybody's like, well, what's the next hot neighborhood that this is happening at? You know, like, where is your prediction that this will like move to? And I think when thinking about us, like a collective us kind of looking to other places such as the East Side, it's like, what does that mean for the people that are already there? Mm-hmm. People are always asking us like, well, where are things happening? Like if you look at the Truce Corridor, like it's just all alongside of it, there's development happening all the way down to like Hospital Hill. And this similar thing is happening in the East Side. So the bigger question to me is like, I think artists will shift wherever they need to shift if they need to. But to me, it's always a question of like, how are we approaching the people that are already living there and what that means for them?
So this pattern of artists finding a place where there's some sort of either aesthetic or just space potential, mm-hmm. where things aren't expensive yet, and then that makes those places more expensive, and then moving on, that's the description of gentrification.
Sure. Yeah. And when you look at cities like any other art city in the world, like New York and Soho, like London, Oakland, even Detroit now, like artists kind of pick the city back up in some ways, in some areas. I don't also want to, like, I feel like the artists are saviors kind of thing is not right, but they make something appealing and people come in and develop it. And yes, it is, we're kind of, I feel like artists tend to be kind of like the
first gentrifiers.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I am curious about the answer to Kathy's question.
I might have a question, but I don't know if we do. I have a minute to.
Not a minute.
I mean,
not
a question,
second.
But a comment. Yeah, I would think that, you know, generally if it's around $1 a square foot, and I think, you know, when artists, they put a lot of sweat equity into something, and they, as Patricia said, they make it attractive, they make it a viable space. The problem is, how do they get that equity back out again? When gentrification comes.
And that is a long-standing problem. If someone finds the answer to that question, I hope they'll tell us. We are at KCURCST. Our time is up, but thank you so much for talking about this, and keep talking about it. Davin Watney, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Brandon Frederick, Patricia DeBildox, good luck. Keep us posted.
Thank you.
Patricia has been part of Front Space in the Drugstore, and Brandon has just announced today that his open house will be closing. You can grab anything you missed from today's show at kcur.org/Central Standard. While you're there, sign up to have Central Standard's conversations sent to you like a podcast if that's more your listening style. kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, super commuters travel 90 minutes or more to work each day, and some new research tells us why and where they are. More on that tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rao. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.